The Tax Committee will come to order. Good morning, Senator Chamberlain. As you can see, Senator Rust, we don't have a quorum, but we can begin with your presentation.
Certainly.
Hopefully, as members arrive, we can vote as necessary.
And to be noted, it's very unusual I'm here on time. So I saw on the original agenda you had me last, which is usually where I would be. But I'm happy to
Senator,
to do
some
that.
Of us are chronically a few minutes late, and so
yet
we are here.
Yeah, right, and we are
so
here.
I would say that we, who are chronically late but on time this morning, should begin.
Right. Madam Chair, Senate File 957 is a bill that developed after discussions with representatives from the Township Association based on some comments that I actually made in committee asking representatives of local governments how they would feel with a trade-off between being giving up the market value credit in lieu of not having to pay sales taxes. The representatives from cities were fairly skeptical of that, but following that hearing, I was approached by Mr. Sulem, who said that a couple of weeks prior to that particular hearing, that the Township Association and their members had met, and that was going to be part of their legislative platform. And so working with Mr. Sulem, we had this bill drafted that does indeed do that. It reduces the market value credit reimbursements to the townships and makes them then ineligible to receive them in the future, and then excuses them from the paying sales tax on their local government purchases. So section one deals with the reimbursement on the market value credit. Section two is being excused, townships being excused from the sales tax on their purchases, and then they are also added in section three, along with libraries, etc. And then in section four, once again, they are excused from that obligation. So it's a swap that actually brings in some revenue based on the revenue estimate that you have before you, but it is one that the township organizations support, and I would turn it over to Mr. Sulem, if that would be okay, and he can explain why the Township Association thinks this is a proposal that's to their benefit.
Senator Rust, before we do that, Mr. Sulem, can I just remind you to speak up because it is hard to hear you in this room? And
yes.
Secondly, can I ask you, you zero out the townships on the market value credit, right? And you give them the sales tax exemption. Do you do anything about the property tax statements in your bill? Is there any treatment at all for them?
No, Madam Chair, that was not part of it. That one would assume that if they're not getting any reimbursement for market value credit, it's not going to show as a reduction on the taxes that are paid to that are paid by homeowners in the township itself. But that's a good point. We might want to add some language to make sure that is reflected on the property tax statement that somehow that the market value credit is no longer available to townships, and taxpayers should be aware of that.
Agreed, Senator Ross.
I don't have any language, Madam Chair, but I agree with your point.
Senator Rust, also there are two revenue estimates for the committee. One is a property tax and local aids only. That one discusses the homestead credit reimbursement elimination. The second one is the state taxes only provision. One of them discusses the interactions with the PTR. They're both dated March 21st. I just want to make sure that members have both revenue estimates in front of them.
Thank you. Yes, there are two.
Okay, and Mr. Sulem, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ken Sulem, General Counsel with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And this may be one of those bills where be careful what you ask for, you may get it. But the situation arose from our board of directors after the budget bills of the last 2 years, and the unallotments and the budget bill solutions that resulted in a permanent reduction to market value credit reimbursements to townships from the state, but not from the formula that's used. So what was happening is a statutory built-in shortfall to our budget. We would certify a levy, and one thing for this committee to remember is at the township level, our levies are approved by the voters. A presentation is made as to what the expected needs of the township are. The voters approved the levy at the second Tuesday in March. So 2 weeks ago, they passed that levy. The county then would back off the market value credit formula, and then the state would say, well, we owe you our share, but we're not going to pay it, or only going to pay a portion of it, leaving us with a built-in statutory shortfall that was made permanent in the statutes. And the only remedy to that is live with the shortfall or over-levy. So, you know, if you need $100,000, you'd levy 110, 115, whatever the percent would work out based on the reductions. Our board felt that that is intellectually dishonest with the property owners. It leaves us with budgeting uncertainty because we don't know if the legislature is going to keep reducing market value credits. And so I was instructed to say, look, obviously the first choice would be fund all the aids and restore us all to whole. Realistically, we know that's not something that's on the table. The money's not there. So then the choice becomes what makes a swap that makes sense. And this was one that our board felt, you know, if we're going to keep losing aid, if we're going to be nickel and dime here and there and have these built-in shortfalls and needs for overlevies, the better approach for our residents would be to have honesty with them, saying, yes, the levy you set is the levy you're going to get, but we're also going to reduce the cost of government because we're going to remove the sales tax. If you remember, the sales tax was put in place, I believe, in 91, in part to help fund local government aid programs. Well, if we remove the market value credit, as we've been seeing the trend over the last several years, we're now paying sales tax into a program that we get zero benefit from. So this just makes it fair from our perspective that we're not going to pay sales tax into a program we no longer receive benefit from. Our homeowners will know if you approve this levy, this is the impact you're going to have on your property tax. But the levy you're setting is the levy you'll get, so the township isn't left shorted somewhere during the year. So that's basically the summary of how this came about. I mean, from a pure dollars and cents perspective, the state is the benefactor of this effort. From honesty to the taxpayers and certainty to budgeting, as well as simplicity, we get a lot of calls from townships that are battling with vendors. Is this exempt? Is this not exempt? It gives us certainty. It gives simplicity. And it seems to be a long-term solution for both sides, the state and the locals, when it doesn't appear there's going to be revenues to fully restore and fund the aids the way they were originally established.
Thank you, Mr. Sulem. Members, if you look at the note that says state taxes only at the top, you'll see the fiscal note for the sales tax exemption portion of the bill, which is $950,000 in 2012 and $1.06 million in 2013. So there is a fiscal note. We will lose revenue if the townships do not pay sales taxes, but we also will not be extending the credit. And so if you look at the second spreadsheet, you'll see the savings on the market value credit for not extending the remainder of the program. And by eliminating that portion of the program, there's a savings to the general fund of $10 million in 2012 and $9.4 million in 2013, and about those same savings continuing on. So just for explanation purposes. Members, do you have questions or comments about this bill at this time? Are there folks here that would like to testify either in favor or against this bill? Senator Rust, I'll tell you, I'm very likely to include this in the omnibus bill. I think it's a great part of the plan. We're working on the language that would address the property tax statement issue. And so we'll have that in the bill as it's developed for tomorrow, and folks can look at that language and that proposal tomorrow. But, Senator Rust, I think this is a great start for our bill.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Appreciate that. I do want to point out that this is the market value credit reduction for homesteads only. It's not the ag homesteads. It's
correct.
Just
not the ag.
It's just the plain vanilla homesteads.
Understood, Senator Rust. It's an important distinction. Members, we do have a quorum now. This is our first bill, and I would like to, without objection, hold over Senate File 957 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor signify by saying yes.
Aye.
All those
yes.
Opposed say no. Thank you, Senator Rust and Mr. Sulem. Senator Cruz is with us now. And Senator Cruz, if you would like to begin with your presentation, I think Mr. Noel is here as well. Members, we have Senate File 767, which modifies the education credit for income taxes. Senator Cruz, is this your first time in the Senate Tax Committee?
This it is. It is. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman, committee members. You'll have to excuse me. I'm still kind of trying to catch my breath. I just ran in the door, so got caught in a little bit of traffic this morning with the weather being the way it is. So.
Senator Cruz, I'm going to ask members to take it easy. We were here late last night, and it's an early morning, and we'll have plenty of time all day long to get into it, but I hope we'll give every accommodation to Senator Cruz. Welcome to the committee, Senator Cruz, and if you would present Senate File 764.
Madam Chairwoman, committee members, thank you so much for allowing me to present this bill to you this morning. It's actually probably one of the shortest bills you'll ever see. All we're doing is adding two words, tuition and to our education tax credit. Just to tell you a little bit about what this tax credit is, this is a tax credit that is targeted at low-income families. So what we're trying to do here is expand the opportunity for these families to utilize this credit. these are families that have household incomes of $35,000 or less. So these are definitely needy families. This tax credit is currently allowed for all kinds of things like tutoring, transportation, all educational type issues, be it books, things like that. the one thing that is not allowed is tuition, which is actually the most expensive, oftentimes, part of the education. What we would like to do here is add that in. This tax credit is capped at $1,000. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Peter Noel here and let him tell you a little bit more about the effects and why we'd like to do this.
Good morning, Mr. Noel, and welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Peter Noel, Minnesota Catholic Conference Education Director, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of Senator Cruz's bill that would provide more options, particularly for low-income families in Minnesota, when it comes to the education of their children. The Catholic Conference recognizes that family as the central social institution and therefore have the primary responsibility for the education of their children. The Catholic Conference believes that this is a just and fair legislation that would provide access to one of the basic necessities, as Senator Cruz pointed out, which is the education of our children in Minnesota. While not being proclaimed as a panacea by any means, we think this is a real step in the right direction to promote social justice and economic justice for Minnesota's lowest lowest families as far as income is concerned. There is broad support for this from a myriad religious institutions and school choice advocacy groups. I am honored to chair what's called the Minnesota CAPE, that's Minnesota Council for American Private Education, and that's comprised of a broad array of different educational, non-public educational institutions. And we think this is just one more creative solution, one more tool in the toolkit for parents to select a school that best suits their child's needs. So we would hope that the committee would take this under advisement and consider this for the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I stand for any questions committee members might have.
Mr. Noel, we have also with us Gene Goldschmidt. Sir, would you introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, I'm Gene Goldschmidt. And
I'm assuming you're here to testify,
yes,
either
yes.
for or against the bill.
Yes,
so
yes,
proceed.
I am. And so my name is Gene Goldschmidt, and I have three children that have attended private school for the last 10 years. And so I'm here to just talk about the impact that that's had in their lives and why I'd want to do that. And so it's been important to be able to put those children in an environment, from my perspective, to get them in an environment where they can prosper and do well and get them into an education system that I'm excited about for them and helping them to grow and do the things that I see for them in their future. The $1,000 tax credit, what's important is that right now it's only deductible if you have additional items above tuition, and it's in a situation where a lot of us that are putting our kids in those institutions, we don't have the extra $1,000 to spend on additional items or anything like that, and so it's, you know, to be able to take advantage of that tax deduction to help every little way to be able to put my kids into that situation. You know, especially for folks that you know, my kids go to Maranatha Christian Academy, and it is just an environment there to be able to get them in. We have folks from every walk of life that attend that school, and so every background, every situation. And so especially the people that are struggling financially, to be able to provide them the opportunity to put their kids in there, every dime helps to be able to afford to get them in there. And especially the you know, and I, like I said, I don't have the money to go ahead and spend the additional funds to come up with another $1,000 to spend on a computer or spend on that. It's every penny that we can pull together. It's to make sure that they get in that that environment.
Thank you, Mr. Goldschmidt. Senator Cruz?
Madam Chairwoman, and I understand bringing forth this bill in a difficult budget time that we're facing right now, being that it does have some costs. This will have a fiscal note to it. But I can tell you one thing. I have served this year for the first time on our Senate Education Committee, which is a passion of mine. I lobbied very hard to be on that committee. I have a sincere passion for children, and I think education is one of those things that you know, we do need to invest in. And I would look at this bill as an investment, and I would hope as a committee that you would consider that and understand that we are approaching this from a perspective of meeting the needs of the most needy. If you look at this tax credit and the way that it's formed right now, I think it's just, you know, to folks that are making less than $35,000 of household income, that $1,000 is a significant amount of money. And one of the things that I've learned in the Education Committee is that more often than not, it's these cases of poverty, these cases of low-income families, where we find the greatest discrepancy or gap gap in achievement, and that's what this bill is attempting to address. I think we're really trying to help those kids make a better future for themselves, and so for that reason, you know, I would see this as an investment, and I would hope as a committee that you would consider it. I think in this environment as well, coming from a business perspective, just to take another angle on it, our businesses are counting on us to train up a workforce. And I think part of what will stabilize a community is this solid education and the ability to go out and get a job and provide for yourselves. That's what this bill offers to these children. This bill offers an opportunity for them to make choices about, for parents to make choices about education, allow their children to gain that education, and to move on into the workforce, be successful, provide for their families. That's the goal of this legislation. So,
thank you, Senator Cruz. Are there other folks here to testify either in support or in opposition to Senator Cruz's bill? Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartell. I'm with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And frankly, I think Senator Cruz and the other members have said everything I was going to say, other than that we would also encourage you to consider and pass this as well. All the reasons Senator Cruz just mentioned.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. There is a revenue note dated March 21, members. It should be in your folder, and it shows a revenue impact of $5.3 million in 2012 and $5.4 million in 2013. There is an administrative cost that has not been estimated yet, but just so members know that there is an estimated cost there. Members, questions or comments? Seeing none, without objection, the chair would like to lay over Senate File 764 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members.
We are looking for, I don't see Senator Benson yet, so Senator Tomasoni is here. I know he always wants to talk about minerals taxes.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni, welcome back to the committee. We have missed you here.
I have missed all of you also.
I'm sure.
Pleasure to be here. Madam Chair, how would you like to proceed? Because there's a couple of amendments that would put the bill in the shape that I would like it. And
Senator Tomasoni, I'm sure that the members would be happy to afford you whatever courtesy you'd like there to put the bill in the shape you'd like. And then I know Mr. Ahern is here, and he can maybe help us explain some of the changes that you're going to make.
Okay, so would you like me to just to start with the base bill and then we can go to the amendments? Or
that would be great, Senator
okay.
Thomas.
If we could put the A1 amendment on the bill, Madam Chair, then that would put it in the form that I want it in, and then I think Mr. Ahern has another amendment that he wants to add onto the bill, and then I can explain the bill itself. Basically, what the A1 amendment does, Madam Chair, is put the bill in the correct form, and then in addition, it extends the 0.3 cents that's per ton that's going to the Hockey Hall of Fame in Evelyn.
Senator Tomasoni, can you pull that microphone just a little closer, and could you speak up? It's hard to hear you.
Okay. This is the I think if we can put the A1 amendment on the bill, then that puts it in the form that I want it in. And then I think Mr. Ahern has the other amendment. I don't have the other amendment, but I have the language here in front of me. So I don't know if you have the A1 amendment in front of you or not. They do.
Senator Thompson, we have the A1, and the chair would move the A1 amendment as a courtesy to the author. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Senator Thomas, only the A1 has been adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, and so the bill itself, Madam Chair, is Senate File 681 refers to non-ferrous taxation, and I just want to point out that virtually all of these percentages that you see in here are already in law. There is a change on line 1.14, and that's in relation to the occupation tax. And the reason that there's a change there is because it's been determined by research that the 1.1% is about the same as what a corporation would pay in corporate income tax. So that the way this is set up, that the occupation tax would be the same as corporate income tax, such as what 3M would pay or what Best Buy might pay, and then the rest of the property tax gets allocated in the form of production taxes, which you see in the rest of the page. The extra then on page 2.7, that is a tax that is called a net proceeds tax, which is similar to the production tax, and that percentage, which it's kind of hard to corral, but the percentage there is considered to be about the same as what the production tax on taconite would be. And then the language that you see in section 3 pertains to how the taxes get distributed. This is something that we had set up several years ago and never got into a bill because we didn't have a minerals article back in 2003, and I guess we never got around to doing it again. What you see on lines 3.18 and 3.19 are just a distribution change, so that that's consistent with the amount of money that's going into those two funds per the taconite statute. And the last thing you see on page 4.12 is just taking an escalator out for township relief. It's considered a fairness issue because as the production increases and decreases in taconite taxes, what you see happening is that some of the formulas give more money, some of the formulas give less money. What this would do is actually continue to give more money all the time, and so it would be taking money away from other formulas by having that escalator in. And I think that's the bill, Madam Chair. And the amendment fixes it so that Section 5 comes out of the bill, and that a new Section 5 is added in that just extends the money going to the Hockey Hall of Fame. So I think that's the bill.
Senator Tomasoni, I just have to say, every time we talk about taxes, your voice gets lower and lower and harder to hear. These are complicated questions for us, and we are working on them. Senator Tomasoni.
Go ahead. I should point out, Madam Chair, everything in here, with the exception of the escalator that I talked about, is only an anticipation of this non-ferrous mining happening. So, in other words, Polymet or one of the underground mines that we're talking about mining copper or nickel or any of the other non-ferrous minerals would actually have to go into production. So this is in anticipation of something happening. There's nothing happening just yet. What we're just trying to do is prepare for the eventual future here. And so these percentages that you see in the bill are very similar to the cents per ton that we have applied to the taconite law. So we're trying to just make it very, very similar to the mining of the taconite law.
Senator Tomasoni, why the changes in rates? That's the biggest.
Okay, that was
biggest
that was,
problem I, for me. So I'm trying to understand why.
The one on 1.14. That the reason the occupation tax rate was changed because it was determined by council or by research that now the same rate as what corporations would. The occupation tax is for mining companies, the same as the corporate income tax for regular businesses. And the 1.1% is what they considered the corporate income tax rate to be the same, would line up with the occupation tax. So in other words, they're trying to make it the same as what 3M would pay on their corporate income tax, or what Best Buy would pay on their corporate income tax. So that was the attempt to make that equal. And the other change that you see on the tax imposed, that is percentages and cents don't often line up, but that 3.35% is an attempt to make that the same as what the production tax is on taconite.
Senator Tomasoni, why should the new non-ferrous mining taxes go to be distributed locally instead of back to the general fund?
This is, Madam Chair, this is exactly the same as what we do with the taconite money. In other words, the mining companies pay taxes in a little bit different way than other corporations do. And so it's set up to work exactly the same as taconite law does, and that iron ore mining law would work. And so the fact that they're extracting minerals from one area and then distributing it locally as well as statewide, it gives you basically the same distribution as what we do with taconite law.
Senator Thomson, I understand you're saying that they should be consistent. And I'm not convinced yet that they should be, that we're going to open up some new mines, new non-ferrous mining industry, and I know that we have distributed the taconite taxes to local communities, cities, counties, school districts. I'm just questioning why, with these new mines, should it be distributed that way instead of towards the general fund? And I'm not.
There is money going to the general fund, Madam Chair. That's what the occupation tax is, and that's what corporate. Basically the same as what a corporate income tax is. That's the difference between mining and regular businesses. But the second part of it is that the distributions that you're seeing would be the same as what the property tax would be on a normal business. And what the attempt here is to do is to distribute it district wide so that not just the local people that are doing the mining get all the money, but that the entire area where mining might have been or has been affected by mining and then can be actually be the beneficiary of the mining allows the rest of the distribution that you're seeing here to be what we would consider to be the property tax part of businesses. So there is a part going to the general fund, and then the rest of it is what would be considered property tax part. Ad valorem, in other words, that we're spreading district wide. So it's basically the same as the taconite law, and it's trying to mirror corporate income taxes and corporate taxes from the standpoint that the corporations pay income taxes, and then the property taxes get distributed to the area they're in. So this is what the law is trying to do.
Senator, questions, Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Thomasoni, you may have already said this, but what's a net proceeds tax?
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, it's the tax that is similar to the taconite production tax, okay, in that it's levied on the amount of mineral that is extracted from the ground.
And Madam Chair, Senator Thomas, is that like a tax on tonnage?
Something like that, yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Howe, just one moment. I just wanted to remind members, Ms. Cadoon gave me a copy of that presentation that we had, and I'm looking at one of the pages from that presentation. I'm sorry I don't have copies, but hoping you all kept yours. It talks about the net proceeds tax distributions within the taconite assistance area, and they are 5% to the city or town, 10% to the municipal aid account, 10% to the school district, 20% to the school fund, 20% to the county where mined are extracted, 20% to the taconite property tax relief account, 5% to the IRRRB, 5% to the DJ Johnson Economic Protection Fund. I think that was Doug Johnson. 5% to taconite Environmental Protection Fund. But if the mining was done outside the taconite assistance area, then 100% of the tax was directed to the general fund. And I think the conversation we should be having in this committee is, do we want to distribute new non-ferrous mining taxes in a similar way as the taconite taxes, or whether we should be treating it like it as if it were mined outside of the taconite assistance area? And I think that's a conversation for this committee. Senator Howe.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, do you know, is gravel or limestone or granite taxed the same way where the local jurisdiction gets to production?
Senate Council can
maybe
answer that.
Maybe.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, there's a separate tax for aggregate materials and gravels included within that, and I believe limestone is as well. And that's a county option tax. There are a number of counties listed in the statute who are authorized to impose that tax.
Okay. And that goes to the counties then?
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, yes, that is distributed. It's split between the counties. If there's a formula. The counties get a portion of it, and the townships get a portion of that tax.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions or comments for Senator Tomasoni? There is an A4 amendment, and Mr. Ahern is here. Where do you go?
Madam Chair,
have you seen the A4, Senator Tomasoni?
Yes, I have, and that's okay with me, Madam Chair. I think that's something that was put together back in part of the 2003 agreement with another company that was the predecessor to Polymet, which was Tech Cominco. And it was clarification language about net proceeds and non-ferrous mining issues. And if you would like an explanation, I can have Mr. Ahern come up and explain it, or I can read to you from the bill summary that I have here. And but I think it's clarification language, and I don't think it's controversial.
Members, my understanding is these are technical changes that need to get made and that they are non-controversial, but Mr. Ahern is here and can testify, generally speaking, what we're trying to accomplish with this amendment. Mr. Ahern, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mike Ahern, and I'm here on behalf of TEC, which is the predecessor of Senator Tomasoni mentioned to Tech Cominco, which was the first company that back in 2002-2003 looked at the net proceeds tax as they were actively looking at the non-ferrous mining rights that they had, and realized that the current law had some ambiguity, and there were a lot of meetings with the Department of Revenue and other stakeholders to look at the statute and as the result of that, those discussions ended up in basically the language that you have in A4, which was technical language designed to remove some ambiguities. For example, as Senator Tomasoni has mentioned, the net proceeds tax is in lieu of the ad valorem real estate tax. Unfortunately, that wasn't real clear in the statute, and that's what Section 1 of this amendment clarifies. excuse me. And there is another change that's, I think, important that reflects the nature of the business of mining and refining of copper has changed. And the intent was to encourage mining of the raw material and, if possible, complete that to a finished good, such as copper, out the other end of the same plant. And so that amendment is contained in throughout the A4 amendment to make clear that the taxable event includes the refining, the potential refining of the material. And Madam Chair, the other issue that this amendment takes care of is it cross-references and makes the deductions allowed under the net proceeds tax the same as the deductions that are allowed under the occupation tax. Under current law, the net proceeds tax, which has never been actually imposed on anybody, there were significant deductions such as interest, such as a loss carry forward, other significant issues that were specifically not allowed as deductions. And so it is a significant issue to make the tax structure of both taxes the same. And with that change, the industry, the net taxes to the industry reflected in Senator Tomasoni's bill is going to be the same. The issue of who gets more under the occupation tax versus the net proceeds tax is a policy issue for this body, but the net amount that the company or the industries would pay would be the same.
Council, could you address, there is a sales tax impact in the A4 amendment?
Members, on page 2 of the amendment, sections 3 and 4 do establish sales tax exemptions. One would be extending the existing
exemption for production materials that are used in taconite to the other ores and minerals, and the other would be in Section 4, an exemption for construction materials and equipment in construction of a facility for non-ferrous mining.
And there's, Senator Thomasoni, there's nobody mining yet types of the non-ferrous mining. There's nothing going on right now. So what we're really doing is trying to set up what the state's policy is with respect to this type of mining.
And that's correct, Madam Chair. And part of the reason for that is because when a prospective company does take a look at whether or not they want to mine in Minnesota, they at least have a roadmap to see exactly what's going to happen in the event that they do start mining.
Members, questions or comments about the A4? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Thomasoni, on that last point, I understand that what you're doing, I just think it's, I mean, there are lots of things that might start up a business in Minnesota and saying, well, we'll exempt you from sales tax or construction materials and equipment sales tax. It does seem to me that we usually at least discuss or debate that. I understand the desire to have the non-ferrous mining, but I just want to comment that I don't know that we, anytime somebody's starting a new business, that we exclude it because, well,
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I think construction material is exempt from sales tax for all businesses. It's a matter of when you collect it, and I think that in current law, and I think you're trying to fix it, they pay the sales tax, and then they can apply for the refund, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Council may have a different approach here.
Madam Chair, the exemption is for capital equipment, and that is a refund situation, but not construction materials. Those have been exempted on a case-by-case basis.
Okay.
Other questions or comments? Senator Thomasoni, I appreciate that we're trying to be proactive in this, and I know you're trying to make way for new business in Minnesota, and I appreciate that. I think there are some significant policy questions for the committee on this, and honestly, I don't know where it's going to go yet, but there's more work to be done, and so I invite you to help us keep working on these issues as we develop the omnibus bill.
And Madam Chair, I just want to point out that what we're trying to do with the net proceeds tax is to do exactly what 3M or Best Buy does with their property tax and their corporate income tax, and that part of it goes to the state, and then the rest of it goes to the districts. And so it's then this is just divided up in the same way that the taconite tax would be divided up. So,
well, members, I'd like to act on the A4 amendment, and I would offer the A4 amendment on behalf of Senator Thomasoni. Questions or concerns, comments about the A4 amendment? All those in favor of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say no. The A4 is adopted, Senator Thomasoni. And for those that have just joined us, I just want to clarify, Senator Thomasoni, when you say that you want the non-ferrous mining to be distributed the same way as the taconite, that actually includes the IRRRB fund, the Doug Johnson Economic Protection Fund, the Taconite Environmental Protection Fund. Do you really think that all the non-ferrous mining net proceeds tax distributions should include those funds?
Well, Madam Chair, it's a fairness issue, and it's an issue of an area that has had an industry that has been its base industry for many, many years, and much of what happens is big holes get dug in the ground, and yes, the area benefits by the industry and the jobs that are there, but at the same time, there's a legacy. And so the spreading out of the taxation and the ability to make everybody in the area a beneficiary as opposed to just the immediate town or township makes it fair for everybody, because otherwise we'd have great big pockets of wealth and great big pockets of poverty. And so by going all across the area with this type of a taxation policy makes it fair for everybody.
Senator Thomasoni, do you still believe that the general fund supplement should be made up to the to this distribution on the production taxes? I'm talking about that 22-cent supplement from the general fund per ton.
I'm not sure what you're referring
to. I don't mean to catch you off guard.
I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Madam Chair, maybe I can help with that. Not all of that 22 cents, but the majority of it was a deal that was made in 2001 in the large tax bill when the investment tax credit, the money available to the mines to reinvest in their properties, was raised from, I believe, 15 cents to over 30 cents a ton. And a deal was made that part of the money would come from Iron Range Resources taconite proceeds, and part of the money would come from the state's general fund. So I believe the largest share of that 22 cents is actually money that's being rebated back to the mining companies to reinvest in improvements in their plants. So, that was all. There was a strong push in 81, in 2001. The mines were in a very difficult time. LTV was on the verge of going down. Several others, including Bethlehem Steel at Hibbing, National Steel at Keewatin, were on the teetering on bankruptcy. All of them ended up in bankruptcy. So there was an effort on the part of the legislature to provide additional reinvestment into those plants, and that's where the general fund money came. It actually, the lion's share of it, not all of it, ends up being rebated back to the mines through the investment tax credit.
Senator Box, the truth, there might not be as much justification for that now, since the mines are reopening and are more productive than they were in 2001, they're not facing the same kind of financial challenges?
Well, Madam Chair, it's different. The original reason for the investment tax credit, and it started, I believe, in 1992, to rebate some money back to the mines for reinvestment, was that basically all the mines were integrated producers. What that means is the people that owned the blast furnace also own in Pittsburgh or Cleveland or anywhere in the lower Great Lakes, they also own the mine. And so the mines were having a difficult, the mine sites of the company were having a difficult time finding capital to improve their facilities. And so the idea of the investment tax credit was to provide a state incentive that could then be matched. And I think it largely worked. So the general managers of the mines were able to go to the corporate boardroom in Cleveland or Pittsburgh and say, we need some reinvestment in our plant, and the state is willing to provide some matching money through this investment tax credit program. That's how it originally started. And it worked. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars were reinvested. It was a good investment for the corporate boards because the state was leveraging some of the money being reinvested in their facilities. What has since happened is the only integrated, I guess we have two integrated producers left, ArcelorMittal in Virginia, which is a small plant that produces just over 2 million tons, and then U.S. Steel's two plants. U.S. Steel is still an integrated producer. LTV is gone. Hibbing Taconite is not an integrated producer anymore for the majority Cleveland Cliffs owns a share. So they're not integrated producers that have to go to the corporate boardroom and leverage investment to reinvest in the mines to the extent that they were. The Eveleth plant is now owned by Cleveland Cliffs, who doesn't have a blast furnace, for example. Same is true for North Shore Mining Company, owned by Cleveland Cliffs. They don't own a blast furnace. So the argument about needing the investment tax credit to leverage money in the corporate boardroom probably is not as strong as it used to be. I think it still is. But I would argue the need for reinvestment in the plants is still there. These mines are old. They were generally, the operations that are running today were built in the 70s. So the need for reinvestment is still there. You'd have to ask the companies how hard it is to leverage corporate investment in the mines. I would argue it's probably not as difficult as it used to be, except maybe in the case of U.S. Steel, because U.S. Steel actually is a very strong integrated producer still.
I don't want
to speak for the companies. But.
Senator Thomas.
And Madam Chair, I don't believe that's in the legislation in front of you, but that's in taconite law. It's not in the precious minerals and
Senator Thomasoni, we had an overview, and so I'm trying to make sure members see there are some connections between what you're doing here, what's happening with the taconite tax and the production.
Absolutely.
And to Senator Bach's point,
there's more production now than there was in 2001, and so since there's more production than in 2001, there are more revenues being generated by the mining.
Oh, Madam
and
Chair.
So there's less justification for the 22-cent supplement.
Madam Chair,
Senator Thomasoni.
The mining industry has traditionally been a boom and bust industry. I always say when the steel industry gets a cold, we get the flu on the Iron Range, and it's basically because the world market is very sensitive to the price of steel and the production of taconite. And so what we've done, and you've probably had this in your presentation, is we put in what we call 3-year averaging for the way that the proceeds are distributed. And while we have had several years of close to 40 million tons of production, back in 2009, I believe it was, we only had 17 million tons of production. And that was a direct result of what was going on in the economy. And so by having 3-year averaging, we kind of level out the amount of money that's getting distributed to the counties and the school districts and the cities, as well as to the IRRRB, and so that's intended to mitigate the blow of the boom and bust. And so while the industry might be back, the numbers are not real high as far as the average is concerned.
Well, Madam Chair, if you're looking at that general fund money that goes to the agency for one of the potential reductions in the committee expenditures, I guess what I'd ask, and I'm willing to do the work, I guess, is we take a look at, in conjunction with that, I think we have to take a look at the 30 cents that get rebated back to the mines, because that's where the lion's share of that money goes, and reduce that money that actually gets rebated back to the mines in conjunction with the general fund reduction. And I'm willing to have that conversation. I understand the situation we're in. It's just that it's more than just the general fund. It also, because it's very closely linked with the rebate that's available to the mining companies.
Good advice, Senator Bach. Senator Thomasoni, other comments?
No, Madam Chair.
Other folks that would like to testify either for or against this bill or speak on this issue? Senator Thomasoni, you know that I have some concerns, and I hope you'll continue to work with me on the issues. I know Senator Bach will. Without objection, the chair would like to lay over Senate File 681 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Senator Thomasoni. We also have Senator Benson in the committee. She's here.
Let's get amended on.
And Madam Chair, I'm really impressed that she's back.
Senator Thomasoni, it's impressive. Well,
we had a big amendment here.
Senator Benson, congratulations on Claire Ann.
Thank you very much.
You will be extra nice to Senator Benson. So if there's any criticism, I'll take it. Senator Benson, you have a general fund income tax checkoff, and I'd love to hear what you have in mind.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for allowing me to appear before you this morning. I have Senate File 294, affectionately known as the I'm Not Taxed Enough Already Fund checkoff. This bill came out actually from door knocking as a fellow candidate. You spent a lot of time at doors, and every once in a while you'd walk into somebody who was willing to pay more taxes for a better Minnesota. Well, this will accommodate them. It would be a line added to our current tax forms that would simply, as the bill describes, allow individuals to reduce their refund or increase the amount paid in by an amount exceeding $1. And I'm happy to say I have a positive fiscal note. The Department of Revenue believes that people will actually do this. And it'll be a good thing for Minnesota and for those people who do want Minnesota government to have more revenue to do what we do very well here in Minnesota. And I do have one witness who would like to testify, if I may. Call forward my witness, Noran Dillon.
Ms. Dillon is here. Welcome to the committee. Senator Benson, while she's approaching, can you have decided to credit these funds to the general fund.
Yes.
Can I ask, did you consider the reserve fund at all for the designation of these dollars?
I didn't consider any special funds. And to be honest, the reserve fund didn't come forward in my mind. I see that we have special funds for our sales tax, and we have special funds for the non-game wildlife checkoff. We've gotten really good at creating little pots of money that can only be used for certain things. And so I put this forward to put into the general fund.
Good morning, Ms. Dillon. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and good morning, members of the committee. Thank you as well for allowing me to appear. I was a candidate last year for this body. While I was not successful, I knocked on a lot of doors and talked to thousands of people, and I heard the same message. And I was surprised because you always heard a couple outlier messages, what was important to people, but this became a pattern. We did not discuss this at all. I just happened to become aware of her bill last week, and I contacted her right away in order to testify to it. I heard very many people say that I am willing to pay more in taxes to support our schools, to support transportation or the environment, so much so that I might have been the author of this bill had I been successful. So I'm here today to urge support of its passage. This is already codified. Statute 16A.013 permits the Commissioner of Management and Budget to accept gifts for any proper state purpose or function. By adding this line onto our tax forms, we will make that option available to more people who it clearly is their choice to do this. While it is not going to solve the state's budget problem, it becomes another tool in our belt for raising revenue. And I don't know if any of you happened to see the Star Tribune yesterday, but there was actually an article on this about paying voluntary taxes. There was a study done from researchers both at the University of Texas, Dallas, and one researcher from our own St. Cloud State, who showed that as long as people know where their money is going, they're almost equally willing to give it to government entities as they are to charity. So I wanted to come today to be able to speak to this bill. I mean, as informed as a candidate I thought that I was last year, I wasn't aware that we can make extra donations or gifts to the state. So I would ask you to allow people to voluntarily choose to direct their money to the state. And, you know, that's about all I really wanted to say today, is I think that there is a will to improve and provide the resources here to the government. And this checkoff will allow people to do that and publicize it better.
Senator Rust.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Benson. I support the sentiment, but I strongly oppose your bill because we have resisted time and time again muddying up the income tax form by adding additional lines for all kinds of voluntary extra contributions, either well, we've never had one actually for the general fund, but for any and all kinds of good causes. And I think that your goal could be achieved by having the Department of Revenue on the instructions of that are in the personal income tax form, the corporate income tax form, all the tax forms, by asking the department to indicate that if someone wants, they can put in an extra check, rather than adding additional complication. And I know it's just one line, but once we do one line, then why not another line and another line, and then all of a sudden we get a much more complicated form. So I would, I would support requiring the Department of Revenue to say that you can do that and put it on the instructions in a prominent way, rather than adding a line to any of the tax forms. And Madam Chair and Senator Benson, I would ask you to consider that alternative to the requirement in your bill.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Rust. I appreciate the wise counsel. I am a CPA and spent one season in the tax pits at Deloitte, and there is nothing I abhor more than tax complications. But I also do my own taxes, and I know that a growing number of us use electronic forms to do our taxes, which means we don't really read the instructions. We check a box, and we're not really walked through all the steps. I don't think an insertion in the instructions would be as effective in communicating what we are allowed to do as citizens, which is to write an extra check to our state government. And on the issue of complication, I am a big fan of let's simplify. Let's not add any more loopholes to our sales tax. Right now, we have to back out Section 179 depreciation. I think if we want to talk about simplifying, let's talk about some federal conformity. Let's talk about getting our sales tax to be more uniformly applied. I think one line on the tax code, I would trade. If you said we'll do 179 conformity this year, I'd pull this bill right now because it would impact a lot more people. But the fact of the matter is we have mucked up our tax code to the point where I don't think we can fix it shortly, and I think this one line is not going to unnecessarily complicate things.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Benson, I think talking about the substance of the tax code as opposed to the forms is very different. And I think we would be hard-pressed for someone else coming to us, and which they have, and say, well, if we can do it for the general fund, why can't we do it for food shelves? Why can't we do it to support adoption expenses? Why can't, and these are all ones we have come, that have come before us. Why
disabled
can't we
vets.
Do it for
disabled vets?
Yeah, for disabled vets. And I think it really is a slippery slope, even though very high-minded. So I would oppose this. I don't know. You're probably going to put it in the bill anyway, but I would oppose this. I think it's an unnecessary complication, which we could achieve the same result through other means. And as far as electronic filing of tax returns, it wouldn't all of the electronic programs could have a statement that in Minnesota, if you want to, you can include an extra amount of money without having to have it as a line on the tax form itself. Just my opinion.
Sir Ress?
That's my name.
I have a question.
Sure.
Would you yield for a question? The question is if people can put in more money onto a tax form, how would they know that? Is there a provision on the tax form that says if you want more, or if you want to give more to the state, add it below or something like that? And doesn't this accomplish that same purpose?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, that's exactly what I'm suggesting, that the department could put on the instructions that you could have an additional amount contributed, and you could just mark it in your check that it is more. That's all. I don't dispute the goal. I think it's fine.
Senator Squire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And along the lines of what Senator Rest was talking about, you know, last year was food shelves and homeless. Before that, it was any number of good causes. My solution was that if you're going to add this to the form, you take off the one that's on there. So the form stays the same, but you just have it for a different cause. You know, and I could be supportive of that. But I think that if you're going to go down this path of never-ending checkboxes on the form, it's going to be 20. And you don't have to look any farther than look at what happened with license plates. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a huge deal to add one change to the license plate 10 or 12 years ago or whenever it happened. But now there must be 25 different license plates for any number of good causes. But as a body, the legislature has a hard time saying no to these good causes. So if you're going to add one, I'd take the other one off.
Senator Squay, how many checkoffs do we have on the tax form now?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not an expert, but I think it's one. It's the Chickadee checkoff, and it's for the non-game wildlife fund.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Benson.
Senator Scoy, all those causes that you talked about, homelessness, disabled vets, food shelves. They're nonprofits. They're 501c3 charities is my guess. They already, as part of their operations, are asking for money. The state of Minnesota doesn't make a habit of advertising that you are free to write a bigger check. And I don't think we should spend our tax dollars that way, but adding a line to the tax form I think would give people the option, would communicate that message. The state of Minnesota is not a charity, and food shelves, disabled vets, and the homeless are. They have groups advocating for them, and so I can see a very bright line standard that says we're putting this in the general fund, you're welcome to do this, and keep the charity aspect off the tax code. Let people make their own informed decision about their charities and write the check directly to the charity of their choice. And that's how I would maintain that bright line standard.
Well, Senator Benson, as I said, I could be supportive of that, but I think you should take the current check off then and just have one. Because I think as you will learn once you go down this path, mm-hmm. there will be another whole run of these. And I think 1 year we had the omnibus chickadee checkoff bill because everybody had their good cause that they wanted added to the form.
Senator Hoffman.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of had my question or my comment answered by Senator Benson and Senator Skoy. I was going to ask how many checkoffs we have. You did that. I do support this bill, and I would actually support Senator Skoy removing the other checkoff box because the general fund, that way we aren't earmarking money for any special cause. This can be used for whichever way the legislature decides it needs to be used. So I support your bill, Senator Benson. Thank you for bringing it.
Senator Howell.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You know, I think Governor Ventura tried this. I think he raised a total of $11, maybe. I think if my memory serves me right. When it comes to special plates, I served on the Transportation Committee, and there's well over 60 plates that 60. We have. 68, I think, and we're going to probably add more, 10 more this year. So, you know, but I too, Senator Benson, heard people say that they're willing to pay more, and this does give them an opportunity to put their money where their mouth is and show us that they're willing to pay more. So it does provide that opportunity. I don't think adding one check off, although this may be largely symbolic, it'd be interesting to see if the people who say they're wanting to pay more in taxes will, in fact, pay more in taxes. But I would wonder, and just like Senator Ortman suggested, if you'd be amenable to a friendly amendment at 1.12 and strike the word reserve or general and put in the word reserve. Because I'm also of the belief that if it's in the general fund, we'll certainly find a way. And I think if it's in a reserve fund, it's going maybe to a better use and one for a brighter future. And so I would just wonder if you'd be amenable to that.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Howe, I have to be honest. I am not exactly sure how the reserve funds are accessed. I know that we have spent down our reserve funds. They are quite low, and it seems that, I'll be frank. If I understood how the reserve funds were clearly segregated and not to be touched, I would be amenable to an amendment, but I do not have that information. So if someone would like to educate me a little bit on how our reserve funds got spent and how they are supposed to be protected, then I think it would be worthwhile talking about segregating funds. But at this point, our reserve funds have been fully absorbed. Our general fund is in deficit. And so perhaps Senator Skoy's idea of removing the current checkoff and making reserve fund checkoff would be an improvement to this bill. But at this point, I'm going to stand firm with the language that I have and let this committee decide if it should be included as part of the omnibus tax bill.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Howe's point, I support that, and let me explain why, but I support your position, would ask you to take under advisement whether the reserve would be a good place for this. And the reason why is that we have an operating fund where if if this gets actually made into law, we may see very large contributions in 1 year. It could be, it's not a stable source of funding. So in 1 year, there could be five donations of $10 million, and we end up with $50 million in the general fund. That's normally operational funding, and it wouldn't be available in the next year, and yet we might increase our general fund spending. So then if it's placed into the reserve, that one-time nature would increase our reserve balance for a rainy day fund, and Minnesotans might like to contribute to a rainy day fund for the state in case there is a future issue. But I would be concerned about taking potential one-time money and putting it into the general fund that might encourage one-time spending that creates a problem in our general fund, which has been a problem in the past. So I'd ask you to take that under advisement. And then I just wanted to make one other comment about this. I understand why people think that this is adding complexity, but I don't know why adding one checkoff is any more complicated than all the add-backs that we have added every single year by failing to conform to the federal tax law changes. If you want to talk about measuring complexity to complexity, I would say the checkoff is much easier for people to understand than how you have to add back in income from your federal tax amount to your state tax amount. And we have a whole laundry list of them. We pass that out in committee. And so if we're going to talk about complexity, this is not that hard to understand. And Senator Benson, I appreciate your willingness to bring it forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman. Actually, if I could turn to the committee council, perhaps we could do an amendment at this point. I have learned this morning. Thank you. To remove the current checkoff and designate this for a rainy day or reserve fund. I actually think that that is something that is very workable, given your explanation of how increasing general fund revenue tends to permanently increase general fund spending. Perhaps it would be best to sock this away for a rainy day, and maybe we could generate some of that one-time revenue. People are becoming more financially aware that we're going to need some protection in the case of another downturn. So if that's something that we could work on, Mr. Chair.
Senator Benson, I think what we should do is consider your request under advisement as we lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the tax bill. Further discussion? Oh, Senator Marty, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, just two brief comments, one of which is the general fund just got a $30 million gift this past week from UCARE. I don't know how many recognize that, but it's probably the largest contribution the general fund has had. Other comment was that there's a little bit of sarcasm in the title of the section, but I think we understand the discussion. I just wanted to make the point that there had been a $30 million gift last week.
And Senator Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Marty. I do remember the $30 million gift from UCARE, had not prepared it as part of my comments this morning, and I am fine with striking the title. Certainly not something that needs to be included in any of our state statutes.
Any further question? Chair lays over Senate File 294 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Moving on, Senator Howe.
Senator Howe, this is not your first bill in the committee this morning, is it?
No, it's not.
Just want to make sure everybody's fully aware that he's experienced.
Sure.
Ready, have that in members.
Absolutely.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair and committee members, to Senator Cruz's point, this is a much shorter bill than Senator Cruz's bill that he said would be the shortest bill you've seen. Senate File 900 is a bill that relates to taxation. And we have, in 2007, state of Minnesota repealed the anti-scalping laws that we had. And what this bill seeks to do is to clarify the taxation as it relates to resale of tickets. And
the ticket portion or the taxation on a resale ticket would be that resale portion that would be above the face value of the ticket, because taxes is already collected on the face value. So when you would resell a ticket, if you sell it for above face value, there would be tax on that portion. So that's what this seeks to clarify. And I have with me here Mr. Paul Cassidy, and he can speak further to clarify it, Madam Chair.
Mr. Cassidy.
thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Cassidy with the law firm Flinner Street and Diner, here on behalf of Ticket King, which is a local ticket broker that has storefronts next to XL Center and also next to the Metrodome. You may have seen their signs. Ticket King resells purchases tickets from local sports teams, local venues, local entertainment venues, and individuals, and resells tickets to customers. As Senator Howe alluded to, Ticket King moved to Minnesota in 2007 after we lifted the ticket scalping ban. They had previously been located in Hudson, Wisconsin. But before they did that, they had to make a business decision to move here from Hudson, and that is, what were the expenses that would change? What kind of business model would they have to operate under versus operating in Hudson, Wisconsin versus Minnesota? And before they made that move, they contacted the Minnesota Department of Revenue and asked them how they would apply the sales tax laws in Minnesota to their ticket transactions. It was a unique transaction, and they needed to know an answer before they moved here. The answer they got was exactly as Senator Howe alluded to, and that is that only that portion of the ticket above the face value would need to apply the sales tax to in the transaction that Ticket King undertook with their customers. Ticket King operated under that opinion for 3 years, up until late last fall when the Department of Revenue sent them a letter and said that they had reversed their decision and that they would now need to collect sales tax on that entire transaction of the ticket that they sell to their customers. What we're here today to ask you to do in this Senate file is to clarify that for these transactions exclusively, and we believe this only applies to Ticket King itself, that you need only collect the sales tax on that portion above the face value when selling these tickets. Madam Chair, I have here with me today Mr. Brian Obert, the owner of Ticket King, who would like to add a few words and comments, and we'd be more than happy to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to speak today.
Can you introduce
Brian
yourself
Obert,
for the record, sir?
I'm sorry?
What was your name, sir?
Brian Obert.
Thank you.
I'm a small business owner, one of the co-owners of Ticket King. We started Ticket King over 15 years ago in Hudson, Wisconsin. We currently employ 19 people here in the state. We moved our business to Minnesota back in 2007 when the scalping law changed. And a big part of that decision was based on the advice we got from the Department of Revenue. We made a huge investment moving into the state. We built two offices, one in Minneapolis and one in St. Paul, and we doubled our workforce. In August of 2010, like Paul was saying, the Department of Revenue sent us a letter and they stating that they had changed their interpretation, which would put us at a huge competitive disadvantage. You know, basically doubling taxation on the face value of the tickets. We really want to stay in Minnesota, but you know, we might or probably be forced to move out of the state, you know, if we don't pass this bill. This would impact not only my family, but you know, all of our employees and their families as well. This bill would solidify the department's original position and would remove any doubt on how ticket resale is taxed. That's about it. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Senator Limmer.
Thank you. Mr. Olver, you talked of a competitive disadvantage. Could you tell me who would be your competitors in this type of business? And why? And if it's kind of the same playing field right now, for corporations in Minnesota, how are you disadvantaged in this policy?
Senator,
Mr. Obert.
Most of our biggest competition comes from the internet. And, you know, big companies located, you know, in California, New York, and you know, they're not charging any sales tax, so, you know, if we had to charge tax on the entire sale, it's, you know, almost 11% more that we would have to charge versus our competition.
And Mr. Olbert, just so I get a perspective, the sales tax on the existing or the original ticket you buy and then you resale, could you give me a dollar amount of what that might represent as a loss from your corporation in an annual sale?
Mr. Olbert.
I guess I didn't totally understand your question. How much tax we're collecting, or how much we would lose?
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Olbert, you're wanting to, by this law or this bill, you want to recognize the first sales tax that you pay when you buy the original ticket. And you don't want to be taxed again or double taxed for that small portion, the original ticket price. So how much does that represent in cash to your business, that portion of sales tax that you want to annul?
Mr. Olbert.
I guess I you're looking for like a total for the year or for the sale?
An annual figure would be fine. I just want to know how much it impacts your business or any other business that might set up shop in Minnesota.
I think, you know, the biggest impact would just be, I mean, we'd be losing out on sales entirely because we'd be priced out of the market charging that much more than what our competition is charging.
All right. Maybe I can reword it in a third way. Mr. Olbert, you want to not count you're going to pay the sales tax on the original purchase. When you sell it for whatever dollar value you sell it, you just want to pay sales tax on the balance or the difference. And I would imagine you know what you pay for your original tickets that you purchase in the first place. And you know in the last year what you sold those tickets for, so all I'm looking for is just how much are you trying to save your corporation by passing this bill? That's all.
Senator Limmer, maybe I can address that. My understanding, and Mr. Cassidy or Senator Howe, Mr. Olbert, please correct me if I'm wrong, but you're talking about a ticket that has been sold and purchased once, and right. The sales tax has been paid on 100% of the original purchase price. Now it's on the resale market for a second sale. And what folks are asking for is clarification that with that second sale, the sales tax to be collected would be on the amount over the original purchase price. So if the original ticket was $100, we collected the state sales tax on that purchase. Now the resale value is $125. And the question is whether on that second sale the sales tax should be on the $25 or the $125. And they're seeking clarification on that they would prefer it to be the $25. I'm just trying to make sure members understand what we're talking about here. Is that a fair statement of what you're seeking guidance on here and legislation on, Senator Howe?
Madam Chair, that is exactly, we just had that conversation with explaining it down to a certain ticket level, and that's exactly the prices we used, and you did an excellent job of explaining it.
All right. Sometimes it takes us a couple times around here. Okay. Senator Scoy and then Senator Russ.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Olbert, do you always pay the original face value when you're buying tickets for resale?
Madam Chair,
Mr.
Senator,
Olbert.
No, not always.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Howell, then I think you should change your bill so that the sales tax is paid on the difference between what they pay and what they sell the ticket for. Because that way you would have a tax burden on the entire purchase from the consumer.
Senator Rust, to follow on that.
However, that's not my question, but a response. But the tax has been paid even on the original sale price, even if it wasn't paid by the reseller. I'm interested, Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair, to Senator Rust.
Senator, go ahead.
who paid that on the original face value? They didn't when they bought the ticket.
The purchaser did. The original purchaser
he's the
paid
original
it.
Purchaser
no, no,
he
he's not.
It.
He's the reseller.
I think if I can try one more time, Senator Rest.
I think it'd be helpful to the committee to hear from the Department of Revenue and why they changed their interpretation, and whether this clarification is necessary in statute or whether it is something that or why we need to do this and why they changed their position.
Senator Rest, we will hear from them. They are here to address this. I just want to clarify, I think Senator Skoy's point, and gentlemen, correct me if I'm wrong, but the first purchase has a face value of $100. Somebody bought that ticket at $100, paid the sales tax on that $100. Now, you're buying the ticket. You may buy it at a reduced price of $25, and you're going to sell it for $125. And you want the sales tax to apply to that amount over the $100. But the original $100, we collected the sales tax.
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, that is exactly right.
That's right.
And otherwise, I suppose you could get real lengthy on here and have them file for a tax refund for the price that, you know, let's say if they bought it for $25 and sold it for $100, you could get real complicated and say, well, they should be able to file for a tax, pay the tax on $125 and then file a refund. They should get refunded back the sales tax that was collected on a $100 ticket. But to your point, Senator Skoy, you're right. They might buy it for less than face value, but the taxes have already been paid up to face value, and any profit that they would generate would be in the form of a tax on income tax. So the tax, there's several taxation to the point here. So I think what's missing is there's already been a tax there. So,
Madam Chair,
Senator Skoy,
thank you. So, Senator Howell, when they buy tickets from the Minnesota Twins, the Twins are paying the sales tax on the $100 face value of that ticket?
Senator Howell.
I don't believe that they're buying tickets from the Twins, but if they are buying tickets, I'll let them speak to that, how the taxation would work on that.
Mr. Obert, if you're buying tickets directly, do you pay the sales tax?
Madam Chair, yes.
All right.
On the full face value.
Senator, yes.
But it does leave a really good question, Senator Skoy. So what happens if someone paid the tax on that first $100, but Ticket King buys the ticket for $25 and then sells it for $50? On that second sale, you're saying there should be no tax because somebody already paid up to the $100, and I think that that's maybe a problem because there is a second sale. You've made a sale with that $25, and nobody's paying tax on that second $25. And Mr. Cassidy, a response on that?
Madam Chair, our opinion would be that the sales tax has already been paid on the full face value.
Mr. Cassidy, so you're saying that that second sale, if it's under that $100 face value, should not be taxed again?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
All right. Senator Howe, and then I think we should hear from the Department of Revenue on their position.
Madam Chair, I would just say that would be very similar to like when you trade in an automobile at a car dealership. Let's say if you're buying a $15,000 automobile and your car that you're trading in is worth $10,000, you don't pay sales tax on the $15,000. You get the value of the $10,000.
However, Senator Howe, if you are buying a used car, somebody has already purchased that car, paid the sales tax on it. If you go into the dealership and buy that used car, you pay the state sales tax again, even if it's less than the face value of the car when new. So I don't think the analogy is a good one. I'd like to hear from the Department of Revenue, Senator Hull. Mr. Mossman.
Madam Chair and members, excuse me, sorry, I haven't quite got rid of the cold yet. And I may ask McCall Garber from our legal staff to join me as well, Matt Mossman, Assistant Commissioner for Revenue. Just a couple things. In general, Just 2 points on the general practice with sales tax that are at issue. I think the sales tax in general is a transactional tax. When you make a sale, you pay a tax. If you resell something, you pay the tax again. You know, the issue that is being made here is that ticket price or tickets, for example, are a one-time use item. But the general practice still is that the sales tax is a transactional tax, so you pay the tax whenever there's a sale transaction. In situations where things are purchased for resale, there's a general practice for that also, which is that products purchased for resale can be granted an exemption certificate, in which case then a purchase can be made tax exempt, with the sales tax being collected on the back end when a product is ultimately sold to the retailer. So that's the kind of general universe in which this issue comes before the legislature for a solution, because tickets obviously are something that are oftentimes purchased, sales tax paid, resold, and the issue here is there a practical way of resolving the issue that the author and the individuals would like to resolve? And we have met with Ticket King on a couple of occasions, and so the information that the department provided to them was the perspective that it was a transactional tax and the tax would need to be collected. We have been working to see if there's a way to craft language. One of the challenges is the verification of whether or not what the original, how we would be able to verify what the purchase price of the ticket is originally and be able to know that how that compares to the face value of the ticket and the ultimate resale of the ticket to another vendor. So that is something that we're continuing to have discussions with Ticket King on. I'm not sure if that answers your questions, but that's the start of my comments.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you. Mr. Mossman, do you know how many dollars are affected by the original tax that's paid on tickets like this that might be exempted from our revenue stream?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I don't. And one of the things you'll notice is that we were unable to come up with a revenue estimate for this bill today because we are having trouble sorting through knowing the volume and the extent to which there would be circumstances where the final sale price of a ticket exceeds the original purchase price of the ticket. We don't have good information on that, so we haven't been able to come up with an estimate, but I don't know, Senator Limmer, your question, whether or not there's a real good way of knowing that. There's the potential that the tax, if applied as a pure transactional tax, there's the potential that the total sales tax of what I think is 11% in Minneapolis could be assessed on an individual ticket multiple times. And that, I think, is the point of that's being made. It could be on the original, built into the original ticket price. It could also be assessed if that ticket is resold or resold a third time.
And, Madam Chair, the other question I had is, and I in no way know anything about this type of business, but just in general, are you aware, can they buy tickets from other locations in other states from Minnesota? And if they do, then are they also seeking an exemption from the way you understand this bill? Are they seeking an exemption from other states' sales tax as well, if that's the case?
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I think that would be a better question for the, in terms of understanding the business, for the author or the business. I would assume that they could be purchasing tickets either from the sports teams or from individuals like myself or yourself who are wishing to offload season tickets or other tickets that we're unable to use, or potentially from other brokers who have purchased tickets and are unable to sell them and are selling them to a different broker. I would think that they could possibly acquire tickets in any of those fashion, but I'm not sure.
Senator Howe and Mr. Cassidy, Mr. Olbert, would you like to make final comments, and maybe you can explain
why that practice isn't
working well?
I have a question here.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, if someone buys a ticket, not from Ticket King, but from another vendor, let's say from StubHub, would StubHub be required to submit that tax? Obviously, they don't have a physical presence in Minnesota, so would they be subject to any of these taxation?
Ms. Garber or Mr. Mossman? Mr. Mossman.
Madam Chair, I believe the answer is no, only if they have nexus to the state. So that is the competitive point, and Ms. Garber can correct me if I'm wrong.
And so, Senator Howe, what you're saying is it's a competitive disadvantage that Ticket King has to pay a tax that an internet reseller would not have to pay because he is located here in Minnesota. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, that is absolutely correct. And again, in talking, they're thinking that it could be between $200,000 to $300,000 in revenue. But we do have 19 jobs in two locations, so they are paying property tax. They are paying all the taxes, workers' comp, income tax, unemployment tax, and of course, income tax on the business. So I would just caution, if this isn't included, there again, all they have to do is move to Hudson, and this whole complete problem goes away. So I think we just need to be careful of what we look at. Again, the position is that we've collected the tax on the face value. It's a one-time use. And they're willing to pay the tax anything above the face value. So on significant high-value tickets, the state's going to get their additional taxation.
Senator Marty and then Senator Rust.
Madam Chair, Mr. Mossman, just a question on the nexus issue. The fact, I assume that most of the, I don't know if this is a fair assumption, but for tickets that are for Minnesota events, is there any way nexus, I mean, some products, I mean, you buy a radio or a computer or something, obviously the fact that, I mean, how you'd have a nexus where we're dealing with the Amazon issue and so on. But what about with this one? If they're buying tickets to a Timberwolves game, if they're selling tickets to a Timberwolves game, there's no way to make any nexus because it's explicitly a Minnesota. I mean, it is Minnesota. I was just curious if that's ever been explored.
Mr. Mossman,
Madam Chair, I'm going to turn the nexus question over to Ms. Garber.
Ms. Garber.
Madam Chair, my name is Nicole Garber with the Department of Revenue. In order to be to have nexus in a state, the seller has to have a physical presence in the state, and if they don't, they do not have nexus.
Senator Rust.
Madam Chair and Mr. Mossman, I'm sorry, I didn't hear your name.
Garber, Ms. Garber.
Ms. Garber. Wouldn't the purchaser of the ticket, nevertheless, if it was a Minnesota resident, be responsible for use tax, paying the use tax? I mean, there are a lot of scoff laws about that, but the obligation is still there if the purchaser is a Minnesota resident, even if they purchase something from Hudson, Wisconsin. I mean, we have a de minimis rule. I think, what is it, 150? I don't remember what the amount is, but that we put in place some years ago. But there is still that obligation, particularly if it was a big seller, a big purchaser, let's say a business that purchased enough tickets to trigger the use tax that was above the minimus, de minimis.
No. Madam Chair, Senator Vest, that is correct. There is a use tax, and if a purchaser buys it from an internet seller, they would owe the use tax.
They don't pay it, but most of them, but they ought to.
Senator Rust, other comments? Senator Bach.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that the overriding consideration is the company was looking at moving to Minnesota. They contacted the Department of Revenue up front before they made their relocation decision. They were told by the Department of Revenue how the sales tax was going to be handled. They moved here. Based on that, they now employ 14 people here, and now for whatever reason the Department of Revenue has reconsidered what they originally told them. And I would expect that if they had been told what the current interpretation is, they'd probably still be located in Wisconsin. They probably wouldn't have ever moved here.
It's just my thoughts on it. I don't know what it costs. I don't see a fiscal note. It would be good to know that, I guess, but maybe it's just not in my packet. Maybe others have it. But
Senator Bach, we don't have one yet. Mr. Mossman, to that point, is there one in development now, and about the fact that the department has changed its position?
Madam Chair, on the revenue estimate, there is one in development. Part of it is contingent on trying to find language that would allow us to get to a number as well, where there's less certainty in how it would be, how the language would be interpreted and take effect. So that is in process. With regard to the Senator Bach's other point, we do have documentation from 2008 that it has some consistency with the current interpretation of the department in terms of how these tickets would be taxed. But I also know that there were conversations with this vendor, and so those were prior to my joining the department. So I will learn more about those conversations and follow up on that.
Mr. Mossman. Senator Howell or Mr. Cassidy, Mr. Obert, final comments on this bill? Cassidy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just, first of all, thank you for taking this under consideration. I think this is a serious issue. This is a bill that I think going forward will be the Ticket King bill because it exclusively impacts this one business. I don't think the guys in the street that are scalping tickets or brokering tickets in the street before Vikings games are submitting or remitting sales taxes, and that's not being enforced. And obviously there's a competitive issue here for a business that made a tough decision in 2007 to cross the border and move jobs and double the size of its business in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cassidy. Senator Howe, final comments?
Madam Chair and Senators, I agree. I appreciate the comments that Senator Bach said. That's exactly right. I think if we don't do this, we're going to lose a couple of locations, and we're just going to continue to have a competitive disadvantage here. And I think there is a case to be made that the taxes are paid on the face value, and it's that above. I know the Department of Revenues is struggling with this particular issue here, but I think if we get clarification in the future on maybe a better way to handle it, but I think this would address the needs today, and we could continue to have those 19 jobs in our state. And as we know, every job is important right now. And along with the additional benefits that our state would get with this. So I would ask for your support to possibly include it.
Other questions or comments? Are there other folks here to testify either in favor or against Senator Howell's bill? Without objection, the chair would like to lay over for possible inclusion Senate file 900. Thank you, Senator Howell. Members, we have a bill lying on the table, Senate File 467, and I'm hoping the committee would accommodate me by moving to take that bill off the table so we can consider amendments to it. And so the chair would move that we take Senate File 467 off the table for consideration by the committee. Comments or questions about that? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no. File 467 is before us. Members, you'll remember that what this bill does is it sets up parameters by which our cities can avail themselves of a local option sales tax with pretty strict requirements about what the revenues can be used for, how long the tax can be in place, and the basics of the general election referendum. What it's intended to do is provide a little bit more independence from the state of Minnesota. If the cities don't meet the strict criteria and conditions as set forth in the bill, they would have to come back and ask us for permission as they currently do. They ask for authority, and you'll remember that we heard a multitude of local sales tax requests by local cities, it seems to me to make some sense to set some ground rules, to say under these circumstances, you don't need to ask legislative permission, but anything outside of the parameters, we would still like to hear about the bill before, or the local option sales tax proposal before it gets enacted. I would like to amend the bill and offer an amendment for the committee's consideration. It is the A1 amendment. Two versions of it. A1 dated 3/21 at 4:35 p.m.
That was yesterday.
That was yesterday. Okay. And what the amendment would do is it would specifically link the communities that are setting up local option sales taxes back to our local government aid program. We have essentially three levels of our local government aid. The first level is the need-based formula. This would not be impacted. What this would do is rather create an offset for two additional aids under local government aid. One is the regional center aid, and the other one is the jobs-based aid. And so my belief is that if these communities are strong enough to act as regional centers and to impose a tax because they have enough business in the community to generate significant revenue, that they probably shouldn't also be asking for regional center aid from our local government aid program or that jobs-based aid. And those two programs were added later. So we've got our core of the program, and then you've got the two additions. And I believe that these cities should be accepting an offset to those two additional aid programs if they are operating as a successful regional center. I didn't want to touch that need-based aid because I know that that often helps with the operational costs of the city, but those other two aid bases don't seem to make a lot of sense if they have their own resources to raise local option sales taxes to pay for community centers and other projects that come up in the course of managing the business. So the plan is to give additional autonomy, but with some reasonable checks and balances here. Questions about the amendment? Senator West.
Madam Chair, just a couple of questions for information. How many regional center cities have time-limited local option sales taxes now as opposed to, I think, the ones in the Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth are permanent ones, so they would be excluded. I mean, maybe they're not a regional center, but they would be excluded from this because they would not be they wouldn't have the opportunity to renew because it's always permanent. Or am I misunderstanding that,
Senator Rest? This wouldn't affect any permanent sales tax already in place. This is going forward for those that are asking to do this without coming back for permission. This is not something that would apply to every local option sales tax, just those that want to implement a local option sales tax without coming back to us for legislative approval.
Madam Chair, I understand that. I was just looking at the language in 1.6 and 1.7 that talked about renewing previous ones that have been granted. And I just wanted to make sure that I wanted to understand if there were some that were permanent, and you just answered that question. And then secondly, and I don't believe I was here when you had the first discussion of the bill, but I was curious about the length of time that the summary, the length of time that the tax may be imposed. And, you know, correct me if you change this, but from reading the summary, that's 10 years. But most bonds are issued for 20 years. So what is the provision for paying off the bonds? Or where do you expect the local governments to get the revenue to pay off the bonds if the tax can't be imposed to pay the debt service for the length of the bonds?
Senator Rest, to two very good points. The first one, let me just say that we're going to, I'm going to offer an oral amendment to the A1 amendment that will clarify your first point, okay, making sure that if there is a permanent tax, it's unaffected, and that it is only for purposes of this new authority for cities. And then that leads me to your second point, which is this is a new, very curtailed authority that if you can fit within the parameters, then you have the authority to issue a sales tax without coming back. My thinking was that the 10 years is long enough for a temporary tax. The whole premise is it's supposed to be a temporary tax. If it doesn't work within these parameters, then we probably have some very good questions for you about the viability of your plan, and we'd like to hear about it. But if you can meet all these criteria, which are intended to be tough, then you don't need to come back to the legislature. And we may work on this over time and learn, but I think we need to develop this autonomy on the part of our cities if we can. Senator Rest.
Well, Madam Chair, I would be very interested to hear some comments from the bond houses. I would think, usually when you're issuing bonds, the bond houses want to make sure that not only do you cover the debt service 100%, but you do it 125% and for the life of the bond. And I think there's a possibility, at least, you'd be creating a program that nobody could use because nobody would be willing to touch their bonds. I may be wrong, but I hope that if this is in the omnibus bill that we do have some testimony from people that are bond counsel that would say, yes, this is a program. If a city met the requirements that you put in there, that they'd be willing to issue bonds for, you know, the welcoming center in Rochester. So I'm just curious. I'm not speaking against it, just curious.
Senator Rest, I think it's a really good point, and we may need to extend that and consider extending the 10-year period to 20. I am hesitant to do that because it doesn't look like a temporary tax to me if it's in place for 20 years. So I think we should get counsel to assist us, the bond counsel or public finance folks, Kathy Haney, you know, somebody to look at this and say, is this a realistic approach? Because we don't want to put in place a condition that is just unrealistic and makes it unworkable.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle?
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, one quick question. In page 2, line 5 through 7, we talk that not only a city but a group of cities under a joint power agreement could impose a local sales and use tax. And then on line 8, it states imposition of the tax would need to be approved by the voters of each city. If one particular city voters did not pass their approval, does that mean that the tax would still be imposed for just the balance of the cities, or would it continue to go over the entire joint power jurisdiction?
Ms. Soff, can you answer that question?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, my understanding would be that, and I believe this may go back to a situation where the legislature authorized a group of cities around St. Cloud to impose local sales taxes jointly, but some city referendums were passed and some were defeated or not offered. And I think in that case, the tax did not go forward until the underlying law was modified so that there was a unified going forward.
So Ms. Zopp, all of the cities would have to agree through referendum in order for the tax to be implemented?
Madam Chair, you know, that could be clarified in this language, but I assume that would be your intention, that if this were to be pursued under a joint powers agreement, that it would be the intention that the voters of each of the cities that are parties to the joint powers agreement would have to agree.
Well, Madam Chair, the reason I raise this, let's say a group of small towns are relatively close and they wanted to put some infrastructure development together. Let's say it's a sewer system. So one small city in that grouping could kind of veto the whole purpose of the project if they didn't have a majority buy-in from every community. Is that how you understand it?
Ms. Zoff?
That's all.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I assume that if the cities were not interested in pursuing this, or if a particular city were not interested in pursuing that, they would not join into the Joint Powers Agreement in the first place. So if it was the city itself where there was some resistance, perhaps they would not be included in the Joint Powers Agreement. I suppose it's always possible that the governing board of the city would agree to enter into the Joint Powers Agreement, but the voters would turn them down, in which case it would not go forward, and they'd have to make another attempt.
That does happen, Madam Chair, from time to time when city officials aren't in line with their public. So just wanted to know what the consequence was if one city didn't agree with the rest of the cities, or the population.
Madam, perhaps you can help us if we need language to clarify that, but it would be my intent, and I hope Senator Limmer would agree, that if any one community didn't have the support through referendum, that whatever joint proposal there might be would be ineffective without it. Mm-hmm. Senator Rest.
Yeah, Madam Chair, otherwise you create a freeloader effect. I mean, you get a community that will get a benefit from it, but then their voters don't want to pay for it. So if you don't have everybody in the joint powers cities doing it, then it's really not fair to the others. And also, you probably wouldn't have enough money to pay for the project if you have those other requirements in there.
But I think, Senator Rust and Senator Limmer, I think this is a really important part of this bill, is the suggestion and the opportunity for cities to work together on some of these regional projects that will have regional value. If we're building wastewater treatment facilities in all the little cities, maybe we should be building bigger wastewater treatment facilities for more residents to use, because it's a huge expense and investment on the part of the residents of these communities. And they're challenged right now to find the resources to pay for these big infrastructure needs. So I think it's a very important point. I think we can add that clarification, Senator Limmer, and Ms. Zoff will help me with that. I'd like to go back to the A1 amendment, which creates those offsets to the regional center aid and the jobs-based aid. Any questions about the A1 amendment? I do want to offer an oral amendment. And Ms., it would be on line 1.6. We say imposes a tax under this section. Rather, we will take out towards this section and insert subdivision 1A. Read, imposes a tax under subdivision 1A after April 30, 2011, which clearly indicates this limited authority. So everyone understand the amendment and its purpose, the oral amendment now to the A1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
The oral amendment to the A1 is adopted. Comments or questions on the A1 amendment? Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, could you just explain the formula there? When we talk under subdivision E at 2.4, where it says it might not exceed $300,000 in any year in which the total city aid appropriation under section 477A.03 subdivision 2A.
Senator Howe, are you talking about the A1 amendment?
Yes, A1 amendment.
That's existing law that you're talking about on the second page?
Yeah.
That's the part of the calculation of the local government aid allotment.
And is that just for populations that are under 2,500 then, or is that for any city?
Council has the answer. I believe that's all cities.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, I'll double-check that part of the formula, but this is existing law. We'll check and find out what that applies to.
All right. Thank you.
And Ms. O'Rourke is here from the League of Minnesota Cities. And Ms. O'Rourke, would you like to testify regarding the A1 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to the bill. And if I could address the bill with the amendment on it, if that's
please.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you. As you may know, the League of Minnesota Cities is a statewide organization, so we have all 853 some cities in the state, and we've long had a policy position supporting city revenue diversification, and obviously the local option sales tax is probably the biggest idea that's out there for cities to consider when looking at things beyond the property tax system. The bill that's before you even as amended, gets about 80% of the way there as far as what we would support. Going back to last year, the league did convene a group under the former tax chairs had asked the league to pull together a number of cities who are interested in this topic, and we did that last summer a few times, and we also had members of the different lobbying groups, such as the Coalition and the Metro Cities, in the room as well to talk through some of these equity issues that come up, what sorts of projects should move forward and such. And specifically to the referendum requirement that's part of your bill, our policy position actually speaks to that being more of a local decision, and we've talked about that, Madam Chair, in your office, and we respect what you have moving forward in your bill right here. But for a number of our cities, they think it's more of a local decision on whether or not that should go before the voters. So I'll leave it at that. We've known all along that an LGA offset could be a piece of this legislation moving forward. I think the regional center of the jobs factor part of the LGA makes it an interesting way to do it, as opposed to the full-on LGA running it through the formula, if you will. And if it's okay, Madam Chair, I'd like to be able to review that a little bit more with some of our policy folks back at the league. You've had some good topics today. I think Senator Rest brought up some important issues as far as the bonds that are involved in a lot of these projects, and we work real closely with some of those folks out there, and I'll make sure they get this language today and probably be ready to comment in time for the omnibus bill. I believe that's all I have before you. If there's any questions, I know Steve Peterson is here from the Coalition maybe to address some of this.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Steve Peterson from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. We have a general policy position that we don't believe that local sales tax should be offset. LGA should be offset with the addition of a local sales tax. However, your use, of course, is a little different than what we've seen in the past. So I'd like to reserve full judgment on that. But our formal position is we are against offsets of LGA for sales taxes. The one thing I wanted to bring up just as a kind of an attention, the reason I came out down here, was a lot of the almost all of the sales taxes in greater Minnesota are tied to specific projects right now that are being paid off. And so I think we have to be careful of the interaction of saying, well, we're going forward, you know, it's one thing, going back it's another thing. As we look of, if you're already paying for certain things with a sales tax that are, you know, have been deemed regional in nature, and then offsetting the LGA, so it's kind of just creating a change in the funding for the city going forward for something that was made in the past. Just something to be brought up.
And Mr. Peterson, the way the bill is drafted now, it's only for sales taxes that would be implemented under these provisions going forward.
Okay,
so it
excellent.
Would not have an impact on any previously authorized projects or local option sales taxes.
All right, thank you.
Or the permanent taxes, as Senator Rest has pointed out. Instead, we're just trying to forge a new relationship here, a little bit different, and I think one that, as I said, is intended to grant more autonomy on the part of the cities. And there's more work to be done, but I would appreciate your consideration of the change in that offset to those limited portions, and not to the actual need-based aid in the local government aid. We do have another amendment to the bill itself, but I don't believe we've acted on the A1 as amended. Mm-hmm. Members, I do have another oral amendment suggested by council that we change the date on line 1.7 from April 30th, 2011. Both 1.6 and 1.7, we're going to eliminate the words April and insert the word June to make sure we've clarified what we just talked about. So, members, questions or comments about June instead of April? All those in favor of the motion to change June for April, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. The oral amendment is adopted. Now, members, I'd like to act on the A1 amendment as amended. Comments or questions about the A1? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
The A1 is adopted. Now on to Senate File 467 as amended. Questions or comments about the Senate File 467? We have Mr. Mossman would like to comment, and Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, the question of voting is, I know that Senator Bach raised a question a few days ago about cities that had already already had a referendum preceding a bill presentation for a local option sales tax, and he was questioning whether or not it was appropriate to have the vote before it came here versus after the bill was broached in a civic discussion in the local city hall. And I see here that that is not defined one way or the other, I don't think. It just says that if there's an imposition of tax, it has to be approved by the voters at a general election. So I don't know if it's before city hall action or after. I don't know if that's necessary to define right now or not, but I just wanted to bring it up.
Senator Limmer, I think that's a really good question, and I think I can take a stab at that. Senate File 467 sets up those specific parameters going forward, and so they would automatically require a referendum. It could not be effective until the referendums have actually occurred. Outside of Senate File 467, we have folks that are proposing local option sales taxes. Some come to us before the referendum, and some come after. My preference is for those that come here after they've had the referendum. I know that that's not always been the position of the chair. In fact, I know Senator Bach kind of has the opposite view. I think that it would be an appropriate amendment to our omnibus bill if you wanted to offer that language on Friday to say that on outside of the scope of 467, for generally speaking, local option sales taxes, that would make a reasonable amendment to say they couldn't come back to the legislature at all for permission without the referendum first. Speaking as myself only, I would support that. I know we've had some conversations about that in the committee. I don't know whether you have, you know, complete support on the part of the committee, but I would encourage you to consider it and offer that amendment on Friday.
Madam Chair, I probably share the perspective of Senator Bach that the public should, once there's a vetting of the issue in a city hall, and that it's fully understood, that, and action by a city hall, then the public can be involved with their blessing that decision if that's the way they want to go. But I just wanted to know where this one was going at that point. I'm not sure if I am motivated enough to amend it or not. I'm just kicking that out for discussion.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. There may be others that are motivated sufficiently. I'm looking at the eyes on a few members, so we'll see. That might come up again on Friday. Other comments about Senate File 467? Mr. Mossman.
Madam Chair and members, the rate in the current bill allows for a sales tax rate up to 0.5%. We're just wondering if you move forward with this, if possibly you can consider either setting some parameters on what the rate could be or specific amounts so that there wouldn't be a situation where different cities would end up with a lot of different oddball sales tax rates across the state, so that there would be some parameters as to what the rate could be, that it would have to be rounded to a certain point or that it would have to be a certain percentage.
So, Mr. Mossman, you would suggest that we indicate a 0.25% or a 0.5%, but not to exceed a 0.5%, some language like that?
Well, Madam Chair, I think if I was going to recommend, I would recommend that it be 0.5% or zero, that it actually be a rate that would be an option. But I think if it's going to be a range, at least it should be some sort of rounding mechanism.
Good advice, Mr. Mossman. I appreciate that. Other questions, Senator Poe Miller?
Madam Chair, I just want to reiterate my concern about this approach. I get the impression you're trying to simplify things. I think that the problem with this general approach, though, is that it is actually going to create in the very short term a much more complex intergovernmental relations system in Minnesota that will make us look a lot more like other states, which I believe we will regret. This is kind of a survival of the fittest type of policy. Those who have commercial retail areas will do well. Those who do not will not do well. And I think this is a mistake. I think it's better to consider the state as a whole and not basically set communities against each other.
Senator Pocono, other questions, comments, thoughts on Senate File 467?
The chair would like to lay over Senate File 467 for possible inclusion of the omnibus bill without objection. We have no further business this morning, but we will be back tomorrow, and we will roll out the omnibus bill at 8:30 tomorrow. Thank you, members.